Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we have convened a really interesting and, I think, impressive array of guests today for today's program. I have with me, via Zoom, all of the full-time staff of WGTD for a look back at 2020, and in particular to the two biggest stories that we have attempted to cover over the course of the year, namely the COVID-19 pandemic and also the shooting in Kenosha of Jacob Blake and its aftermath. And in many respects, these are two stories that were immense in scope and complexity, and also two stories in which we were, in a sense, directly impacted and affected. And that, of course, is a really interesting experience when one is in the media and particularly in the news business. And so we are going to be examining all of that. And I want to acknowledge that this roundtable discussion is the idea of the boss, namely General Manager David Cole, who's with us. And also with us is the colleague with whom I interact each and every weekday morning, Dave McGrath, the news director of WGTD. And finally, Troy McDonald, whose official title is Development Director, but that title does not begin to encompass all that Troy does. He is an invaluable jack of all trades. And as the youngest member of our staff, he is also someone who has his pulse on many cutting edge technologies that have really reshaped the way in which WGTD does what it does and interacts with the community. So we have the four of us together again via Zoom to have this conversation about this remarkable year. So Dave Cole, Dave McGrath, Troy McDonald, welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning, Gregory.
Thank you.
Glad we can do all this. We're going to begin chronologically with the COVID-19 pandemic. And Dave Cole, I thought we'd begin with you and have you talk a little bit about what it felt like as that, what I like to call the curtain of COVID-19, was about to descend in the middle of March. I mean, descend on this part of the world. And maybe what conversations were taking place at Gateway in terms of how we were going to be able to move forward and continue to function, given some of the tight restrictions that were imposed.
Well, first, I'd like to say that, you know, historically, I don't put a lot of resources in doing end of the year reviews and series and conversations and whatnot. But how could you pass up, you know, this year, you know, as you point out, COVID and, you know, some of the civil unrest we had. But COVID hit, you know, all of us back in March. And of course, back then, we had no idea how long this was going to last. You know, WGTD historically, you know, during my tenure and well before I got here, you know, we have the strong sense of responsibility to the community. And so, you know, I think we all knew whatever was going to happen, you know, we weren't going to turn the radio station off and go home or take a vacation or move, you know, wherever. You know, so we hung in there. And I think, you know, Gateway made plans to close, and I think for, I guess, months, WGTD was the only office at Gateway that, you know, was actually staffed. And well, we decided for safety purposes that we needed to stagger our shifts. And so, you know, Dave opened up, McGrath opened up in the morning, and Greg, you can speak for yourself, and all I know is I I took care of the afternoons. And, you know, for months, we kind of, I worked by myself. You know, you didn't see, you know, anybody at Gateway in the halls. You know, we you know, were able to get in through the back door and we did our work. And Troy, you know, thankfully was able to work, you know, from home and almost almost exclusively. So, Dave, you may want to provide your impressions.
I wish you would, Dave, because it was really interesting, particularly in those first few weeks, what we were doing and ways in which we were really trying to safeguard our exposure to one another and the lengths to which we did that, especially in the early going.
My first impression of COVID is I haven't worn pants since March 17th. Big boy pants. We come very casual to work now because, as Dave Cole mentioned, for those early months, this building was a ghost town. There was nobody here. But the arrangement that Greg and I made, and this was facilitated by Dave Cole and everybody else, the building we're in is two stories. So the radio studio is on the second story. So the early on in COVID, Greg would, actually the first arrangement, Greg would call on his cell phone from the car. And then he'd have to wait in the car. If he got here early, he could sit there for 5 minutes because we do a break at 10 minutes before 8 and promote what's coming up on the morning show. So depending on Greg's timing, he could be in the parking lot for 10 minutes waiting to call me. So then I think it might have been Dave Cole's idea. Well, how about if Greg comes into the building but stays on the first floor? So that worked, and he's still on the cell phone. And then as I would leave the building, I'd walk over to the ledge and call down to Greg, "Greg, I'm leaving!" And then he would make his way upstairs. And that's how we operated, I think, maybe until October. Yeah. And then, again, Dave Cole came up with the idea, well, why doesn't Greg just go in the other studio? We have two studios here at WGTD. Why doesn't Greg go in the other studio, close that door? Dave, you keep your door closed. And then Greg could actually do that promotional announcement on a microphone instead of a cell phone. It gave us better quality. So that's how we've been operating since March. I see Dave Cole occasionally, but he's been good at not coming in until 1 o'clock. I leave here about 12:30 or so. And Troy McDonald, I keep a picture of him by my desk so I will recognize him next time I see him.
Right. Troy McDonald, what has it been like to be almost entirely remote? I mean, 99.9% of the work you've done since March has been away from the actual studios. How difficult has that been?
Well, I'm actually probably, I mean, in my family for sure, but the most reclusive person that I know. And so it really wasn't that much of a stretch for me. I was comfortable. For me, it was really having that time and space to really focus on what needed to be done. As a millennial, I'm used to having my phone, my Twitter up, my Facebook, the television, and like having to like turn all of that off and say, nope, I got to do this editing, or no, I have to tape this show. That was a challenge. But what was also interesting too in the early going was one of the things that I look over are some of our weekend affairs programming. And so we have hosts for Community Matters and Education Matters. And all of that had to go remote as well. And so I had to take the responsibility of training those people on how to use Skype, how to use Zoom, and get those shows. And that was a training course within itself, because a lot of the times they would just come into the studio and just record. And so now I have to take those files, edit them, process them, and get them into the studio. So for me, it really wasn't that much of a stretch. I like being home, but I miss all of you guys, and I miss coming in and seeing all of you guys and having those conversations every day. And so that's probably the part I miss the most.
Dave Cole. Go ahead.
Greg, if I could interject, I'd be remiss in not acknowledging the work of Russ Weller, who's a part-time member of our staff, and he he runs the Gateway Radio Reading Service, the service for the blind, and he also rides herd on HD2, our jazz service. And he's worked entirely from home. He's got the capability to enter our systems here at the radio station and do what he needs to do. And so his work has just been valuable. And the second point I'd like to make before you move on is one of the biggest holes in this little system that we devised is, you know, our studios usually are humming with a lot of activity, in large part because of the volunteers that we have coming in, recording programs, jazz programs, and also recording programs for the Gateway Radio Reading Service. We've just had to put all of that activity on hold. The readers who read the newspapers for a long time have done it at home to begin with, so they weren't impacted, but we had some feature hours for that service where we had readers coming in reading, and we had to put the kibosh on that and our jazz hosts as well. And I know they're chomping at the bit to get back, and you know, I think we're getting really close to allowing that to happen. But, you know, again, you know, obviously, you know, we can't let our guard down in terms of, you know, watching for the potential for the spread of the virus. So anyway, just go ahead.
And of course, we've not had in terms of this program, for instance, we have not had a live guest in the studio since March. And my understanding is that it's not just our good sense, but we're really forbidden to do so by Gateway. I mean, that is, Gateway has a very strict policy, if I understand correctly, in terms of outsiders from the community being allowed in into the buildings. I mean, you really need to be either a Gateway student or staff member in order to, for instance, be in our building. Am I right about that?
Yeah, a lot of restrictions. And of course, when we get anyone in our studios, you know, if you have a private office, essentially you've got your own computer and your own keyboard and mouse, but in the studios we're sharing a lot of equipment, and that is a big concern.
Dave Cole and Dave McGrath, please chime in on this. What have your top priorities been in terms of covering the COVID-19 pandemic as a news story, and what do you think has been the most important contributions for us to make in terms of trying to add something meaningful to a really scary and unsettling situation?
I'll jump in real quickly. I think it changed over time from when COVID, we first became well aware of it in March, and now here we are in December. What struck me the most is, because I anchor Morning Edition, I do the local part of Morning Edition. Morning Edition is the NPR news show. And at the height of COVID, let's call that maybe June or July, every story on Morning Edition was COVID. We get a rundown of their stories every day, so we know what they're going to do, so we can promote those stories. And I noticed at one point in July, and they do an average of 6 stories an hour, sometimes 7, depending on length, every story was COVID related through July and August. And then I noticed they started to peter off. And I don't know if people know the division of labor here at WGTD. Dave Cole writes 95% of our stories. He reports 95% of them. We call him Mr. Prolific. He can do 3 stories in the time it takes me to write. It was a cold, dark winter day. So Dave would be far, far more versed in telling you how our news coverage changed over the course of the, since March. Dave?
Well, you know, in terms of priorities, and we wanted to get out the official information, the latest information that we picked up from the health departments in Racine and Kenosha and Walworth counties. You know, that's our focus. We certainly allow NPR, you know, through Morning Edition and All Things Considered to handle the national picture. We allow Wisconsin Public Radio to handle the state picture. And our primary concern locally is Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties, what's happening in those counties. And then the final product that everybody hears on the air or reads on the web or Facebook page is kind of a blending of all that. So, It wasn't, you know, as Dave said, you know, the content of our newscasts, we weren't struggling for things to talk about in our news segments. And that's been basically the bottom line of this whole year between COVID and the election and Jacob Blake and George Floyd. So, like I say, you know, we, like I said, you know, it's we take our responsibility very seriously, and we try to do the best we can with the resources we have to cover the local picture.
Troy McDonald, I should have warned you about this question. This is where we'll leave the COVID matter. You probably consume more media than the rest of us combined, I think, and particularly certain kinds of new media that that are less familiar to me anyway. I wonder what your sense is of how American media has covered this story of COVID-19, and if you've seen very much change over the course of these last few months.
That's a great question. I think what has been the most interesting to me as I've kind of gone and as you noted, looked at all the different media sources and outlets, is just how unafraid some of the organizations were to talk about some of the disparities that people of color and other minorities have faced in this crisis. According to American Public Media, 1 in 800 African Americans have died due to COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic, and that's from American Public Media. And so that was talked about, right? Those kinds of disparities were acknowledged, and not just by media outlets, which is of course important, but also by, you had some of the government officials. You had the Surgeon General of the United States, who's also an African-American man, discuss that. So I think that was what was the most interesting. And also what bothered me the most, especially in the early going, was my generation, who again, does not like systems, does not like institutions, is very attitudinal. And how many of us were defiant at COVID at first. And a lot of the early coverage centered around my generation holding parties, 100, 200 to a group. There's just a couple of YouTubers and TikTokers who got fined by the city of Los Angeles for having parties of 300-400 people just a few weeks ago. Wow. And so that kind of, I don't give a beep attitude from some of my fellow young people has been interesting to follow. But yeah, it's interesting. I would say that it's been great on that, on the front of racial justice and equity, right? We're trying to talk about the historical ways in which people of color have faced health disparities, and COVID has just kind of exacerbated that. And then also I've been saddened by young people, and they're just not giving a damn about this. And it's, and of course that's not all, I don't want to generalize, but there's been a lot of that.
Understood. For those of you just joining us, we're having a roundtable discussion about 2020. I am speaking with the full-time staff of WGTD, General Manager Dave Cole, News Director Dave McGrath, Development Director Troy McDonald, and we've been talking, of course, about the COVID-19 pandemic, and it is a story, of course, that is now dramatically changing as we have now 2 approved vaccines and who knows how many more. And while normalcy is not going to be returning instantly, maybe not even anytime soon, we see it on the horizon and look forward to it eagerly.
Can I jump in here just one more comment about COVID, Greg? I've noticed in the last 2 weeks now, at least Wisconsin Public Radio, and it may be because of the end of the year as well, but, you know, we went from the beginning of COVID, it's here now, it's spreading to this country, it's coming to this country. And this is what you should do. You should wash your hands. You should do this. You shouldn't do this. And now we start doing the numbers. Look how many people in this country, this city, this state. Now, towards the end of the year, Wisconsin Public Radio specifically is now doing a retrospective. They're starting to spotlight some of the people in Wisconsin who have died and doing very, very nice remembrances of them. One this last week was the 8 nuns who died in that convent outside Milwaukee. And so I see that arc now. The arc is now, let's remember some of these people and what they meant to the community, what they meant to their families and to each other, as opposed to just their another number. So I thought that was a nice thing that Wisconsin Public Radio has been doing.
I'm glad you said that. There is a certain impact when you're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of people. It's something else when you talk about a person who has been claimed by COVID, and it gives it a very different kind of impact. That's very important.
And one aspect of the story that we found a little frustrating here is that we've attempted to, maybe talk to people who've had COVID or family members who've had loved ones die. And, you know, we all know there's a great reluctance on the part of some people to want to talk about it. And, you know, that's their prerogative, you know, that's their right. But we felt that, and I know, Greg, you had some luck, reaching out and contacting with, some people who've had the disease. But that's been one difficult aspect of the story is trying to reach out to get those personal takes and perspectives.
Right. I can think of all of the COVID victims that I've spoken to on the morning show. There were several who really do not have a clear idea of exactly where they contracted the virus or under what circumstances. And then I can think of someone who does, but who really did not want that addressed in the interview at all. But my most recent guest, who was on Monday the 21st, Warren Williams, a retired pastor in Racine, he knows exactly where he was exposed to COVID. It was in officiating for his nephew's wedding in North Dakota. And it was a wedding that was supposed to be outside until a blizzard hit 3 days before. And so it was moved indoors. And unfortunately, there were quite a number of family members not taking the virus seriously, not behaving as they should. And so he knows that's where he contracted it. But moreover, he was happy to talk about it as a cautionary tale. And so I really appreciated the fact that he was willing to be forthright and was actually eager to share his own COVID story. Well, let's move on to the other really big story that impacted southeastern Wisconsin and was a real challenge for us to cover, namely the shooting of Jacob Blake and the aftermath with the civil unrest, which erupted throughout the city of Kenosha and communities beyond as well. Dave Cole, let's begin with you. This is so different from COVID as a story because we all knew COVID was coming. It was this ominous storm cloud on the horizon, but for a long time on the horizon, but we knew it was slowly approaching. The shooting, of course, of Jacob Blake was something that nobody could have anticipated, although it is just a recent instance of many that have come before it. Just say a word about what it is like for anybody who is part of serious media, serious journalism, when it comes to covering a story that, in a sense, takes us completely by surprise. What kind of a challenge is that?
Well, I guess here at WGTD, the small staff we had, I guess I was glad that I wasn't on vacation when we're out of town and all this hit. And usually, as part of my role is writing, a fair amount of news for Dave, I'm at the station on Sunday nights, just picking things up and seeing what's going on. And so I was getting ready to come to the station anyway. And then I got a call from Russ Weller, the guy that we spoke of who handles Gateway Radio Reading Service and our jazz programming. And he is a member of the Moose Lodge, and he was in the area of the shooting. And he said something was happening. He heard a rumor that a police officer had shot somebody. You know, Dave Cole, maybe you may want to swing on by and see what's going on. And so I was getting ready, and then I got a text or a call from Early in Frederick, who monitors police scanners a lot for us and is around in the community with a camera, and it gives us a lot of photos. And she had indicated that same thing, that she thought that a police officer had shot somebody. So I scrambled to the radio station, picked up my bag of equipment, including the camera, and went over to the scene. And I'm guessing I probably got there maybe within an hour and a half of it happening.
Wow.
And I probably was one of the first reporters on the scene. And it was chaos. There is a tremendous police presence. You know, this was not your typical kind of police presence that you'd see for a shooting, you know, of any kind, even a homicide. There was a crowd that was angry, yelling at police, yelling at me for being there. And so I just hung around and I remember seeing three children standing by a vehicle, and only learned later that those obviously were the kids that were in the vehicle when the shots were fired. They were still there. And I hung out, I talked to a few people and, you know, got their explanations of you know, what they saw. Some refused to talk, you know, others were very angry. And at that point, you know, with the crowd building, we were waiting for some kind of official word from the police department as to what happened. And at least back then, almost all communications from the police department came via news release, and usually a very brief news release. You really couldn't pick up the phone and, you know, to have a conversation with, you know, a supervisor as to what happened. They would always defer to printed news release. And in a situation such as this, you know, even more so, and you can understand where it's a very sensitive situation given that. But so anyway, I hung out at the radio station waiting for a news release. I think I might have dashed home for a bit, came on back. It's hard to remember the chronology, but as I live on the south side of Kenosha, when I was returning to the radio station, I drove past the courthouse in Sheridan, and the dump trucks were already in place. You know, and this is the site that you saw during George Floyd, and during the George Floyd protest. So they were already, before sunset, getting ready for trouble. So that's basically, you know, the first few hours of my involvement.
I'm just curious, in your long career as a news journalist, had you ever been in a situation like that when you first came on the scene, in which there are people who are angry that you are there? I'm just curious if that is something you had ever experienced before, or experienced to that extent.
You know, I'm sure it's happened. I can't put my finger on, you know, some people aren't always happy with reporters to begin with. I get that and get that sort of thing. But this was the kind of crowd that was angry, and they were standing around, and people, I think, were just kind of waiting for something to happen. I mean, they weren't, the odd thing about this is that nobody was dispersing. You know, after a couple hours, usually, you know, whatever wears off and people kind of go back home and, you know, that kind of thing. But they weren't going anywhere. You know, they were there. And I had left the scene before dark set in. And I think that's when problems began right there.
Also, to clarify, when you were on the scene, was the video of the shooting already being shared? Were you aware of that at all, or not?
The funny thing about that was, I kind of circled the scene, and I was standing next to a guy who presumably was the guy who shot the main video that has been shared, you know, millions of times. And he was just standing there, and it looked like he was standing next to a plainclothes police officer. So I was a little hesitant to approach. He disappeared into an apartment building. And so I never got a chance to actually approach him. He seems like he was a little tied up. I probably should have been a little more aggressive in trying to. A lot of people were that witnessed that were just in shock. I mean, to see something like this happen in front of, you know, your eyes. And he wasn't the only, you know, eyewitness. I mean, there were dozens of people. It was a summer evening, a warm summer evening. And, there already had been a ruckus, you know, in front of this apartment building. These shots didn't occur within 5 seconds of police arriving. So people were watching, and then a lot of people witnessed this. And, you know, I think we, we've had an indication, you know, from the Attorney General that as part of their investigation, the part of the Justice Department, you know, they reviewed, I think the number was something like 60 videos. Now, I'm not so sure they were all shot, you know, on the scene, but there were dozens of videos, a lot of video evidence that they had to review as part of their investigation.
Troy McDonald, can you remind us of just when, how quickly the most famous video of the shooting itself was shared with the public? And what are your recollections of the moment that you first set eyes on that video?
Oh, man. So I was scrolling through Twitter, as I normally do, and was just going through my feed, and I saw this video, and it was the caption was "only in Kenosha," or "I can't believe this is happening in Kenosha," something like that. And there was this video, the video that Dave Cole was just mentioning, of that's been shared millions of times. And my first thing that I felt was shock, right? This is happening again. I think, especially for, and I'm the only Black person on air personality in Kenosha. And so the first thing I thought was, again, we had just seen Ahmaud Arbery be hunted and shot. We saw Breonna Taylor be killed. We saw George Floyd. And now this is happening in, you know, my neck of the woods. And to be honest, I was not surprised, because I already knew what Kenosha thought about people of color. And again, this is my opinion and not representing the station. This is just how I feel. And if it gets me in trouble, I don't care. I knew how Kenosha felt about Black people by the way it treated the school that I went to, right? I went to Lincoln Middle School. The way that the streets were treated, the way that I felt going into certain places in town, where I would get my haircut in Uptown as being the place where you don't want to go, right? Those were things that were baked into me when I first moved here in 2004. And Joshua Inwood, who's a scholar at Penn State University, talks about this concept of right to the city, who has the right to different aspects, whether that's the hierarchy of employment or education, right? But it's also environmental, as Kimberly Crenshaw, who's at Columbia, says, it's intersectional, right? It's about the environment. So I knew by where I lived that something like this could happen. Now, of course, the manifestation of that, Jacob Blake being shot, could not have predicted that, but the tension was always there. And so that was what I felt when I first saw it. And then it was, okay, I got to get this video on our social media and say, hey, there has been this shooting that has taken place. And so I was able to obtain the video and get it on our social media within minutes of it being posted on Twitter. And that's primarily in part because I'm so connected to social media. So I saw it when it was posted within minutes and was able to get it probably about 5 minutes later on our social media. And that video on our page alone has been viewed about almost 90,000 times. It's just incredible. But yeah, so I was not surprised. Okay, well, it's happened here now. Now, how do we cover this story in a way that's fair to everyone involved and, you know, tells that kind of history? And so that was my goal, is that video popped on my screen.
The story, of course, is not just of the shooting, but also of the aftermath. So Dave Cole, what are your recollections in terms of grappling with the challenge of trying to cover what ensued in the wake of Jacob Blake, and what were the things you were, in a sense, most concerned about in terms of the shape that our coverage would take?
Well, we wanted to be comprehensive. You know, like COVID, you know, we knew we had a responsibility to be there, basically for those first few days around the clock, to let people know best of our ability, you know, what exactly was going on. we wanted to be accurate. And that probably led to, maybe on occasion, us not being the first to report something. But at that point in time, I was more concerned with accuracy. I also decided pretty early on that we really didn't want to put staff, anyone, in harm's way. That didn't always hold, but you know, we were conscious of the potential danger here, and you know, so we wanted to keep staff safe. Those are some of the things, and we knew, you know, from the start that you know, we were covering this for the long term. You know, the national networks and the national press were only going to be here so long. And then it was basically, you know, sort of up to us and, you know, the Kenosha News to cover the aftermath, and certainly to a much lesser extent, Milwaukee media, Chicago media. So those are a few of the things, I guess, that, you know, rolled around in my mind.
Dave McGrath, speaking of being in harm's way, one of the things that I will never forget is having you describe what you witnessed when you ventured downtown with your wife, Guida Brown, to check out her workplace and to do your best to safeguard it as some of the violence first broke out. Can you just say a word about being in a situation like that?
Yeah, maybe not the best decision we ever made, but as you mentioned, Guida's executive director of a nonprofit, which is in downtown Kenosha. So it would have been the second night of the rioting, or the first night, I'm sorry, it's a long time ago. She wanted to be in that building. Not that we could do anything if anything happened, but she wanted to be there. And I wasn't going to let her go alone. So we went down there. The drive down, because she's on 6th Avenue, at one point we were on one of the side streets, and there may be two cars behind me were heading east. All of a sudden, we confront maybe a dozen, two dozen, and it seemed like kids on little kids' bikes. Now, they could have been 13, they could have been 14, they could have been 17. They all had spray cans, spray paint cans, and they all blocked the road, indicating we weren't going to get by. So I figured, man, maybe that's not a good idea, so we tried to turn around, but now you got cars parked on both sides of the road. And I'm driving a Ford, what do I drive? A Ford Escape, not a small vehicle. And it's hard to make a 180 on a side street with cars on both sides. So I'm trying to do that. There are cars behind me. And now here come a group of punks with spray cans. I'm driving a $30,000 vehicle. I want to get out of there. I was worried as much about me and Guida as I was the vehicle, because who knows what was going to happen that day. But we got out of there. And then we got to Guida's building. And at this point now, Dave's at the radio station. Troy's at home, but Troy's monitoring all kind of media. And some of the interplay back and forth with me and Troy, because Troy was monitoring where the National Guard was. This is after the Guard was now called. And what was happening. Some of it, while this is a tragic event, some of what happened while the National Guard was making its way downtown was somewhat comical. We won't share that now. And when we got into the building, we were there, and it's right near Library Park. And so we were there from maybe 7 o'clock at night until about midnight. And all night long, cars were racing around Library Park, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour. We were far enough away from the courthouse where we heard the explosions. We saw whatever was going off, and we saw the sirens, but we never encountered anybody near our building at that point. And so we were close enough to experience it, but we were still safe. We were sort of like behind the lines backstage, but it was pretty daunting even at that point.
A frightening night, I'm sure. Troy McDonald, explain the role that you believe WGTD played in terms of trying to convey important and useful information during those tumultuous days, and the means by which a lot of that information was gathered and disseminated.
Yeah, McGrath said it poignantly. I had many different screens up monitoring different live streams, different Twitter feeds. So at one point I had 6 or 7 different tabs open, also listening to the Kenosha scanner. And I kind of felt that that's like a lot for people to follow. No one is going to follow all of that, most regular consumers. They want to know what's the most important thing, like what is the big update for this minute that I can take to protect myself, my family, my business, what have you. And that's kind of the strategy that I took. So I looked at these six or seven streams and kind of said, oh, this is happening. Listen to the scanner, and then posted minute by minute updates on our Facebook page of what was happening. And as a byproduct, you know, our followers grew by 5,000 in the course of the first few days after, which again is, it's bittersweet. You hope it doesn't have to come at the expense of people's businesses and livelihoods. You don't want that. But I think it also speaks to the fact that people appreciated kind of the way that we were delivering the content. It was the most important thing for that moment that kind of told what was happening and shared what was happening. And so that's kind of the means of which I used to kind of gather all of that, was looking and monitoring at all of that. And it was a daunting task. I mean, it was a lot of 3 a.m., 4 a.m. nights in those early days. And on top of that, managing my school studies, I told this at one of our divisional meetings, but my teacher emailed me and said, you know, Troy, I know that you're doing a lot. If you have to turn your camera off for Zoom during class, like that's okay. Like, go ahead and do that. And I had to do that twice because I just had to put my head down on my desk, because those 2 hours in class were the only 2 hours that I could lay my head down and just get a breather. Because if it wasn't covering the case, it was thinking about, and this might get a little personal, but again, I don't care, thinking, wow, this could have been me. This could have been my brother. This could have been my best friend, right? We've all had emotional breakdowns. We've had the emotional moments. And what we want in those moments is some sort of empathy, some sort of grace. And I know I've had my fair share of moments, hell, in the studio, where I haven't been the most pleasant to deal with, right? And I just kept thinking, wow, this could have been me, on top of having to cover this story and then manage. It was a lot. It was just a lot. And so putting it all together for the community in a way that was simple for them to follow was the most important thing, but then also managing like my own mental health and sanity at the same time.
Right. I don't envy you at all facing that kind of challenge with trying to cover a story so big in its dimensions, and also for you particularly deeply personal. Dave Cole, in the wake of the shooting and the demonstrations and riots that occurred in those next days, I think you made such a good point about once the trucks from CNN and CBS and wherever have left, we are still here, still trying to cover another part of the story that receives less notice, but is every bit as important, in some ways maybe more important, and that is about the city trying to move forward and to try to come to terms with this incident and what it, in a sense, revealed. How would you characterize what WGTD has tried to do in terms of covering this story beyond the immediate incident and the aftermath?
Well, we've, you know, tried to use all of the resources that we have available to cover the aftermath, and you know, that means our long form programming, like you know, this show, Greg, as well as some of our Saturday morning community affairs programs. Troy did the Saturday after the incident. Troy did I believe it was a 2 hour long special.
Yep. 2 hours
on essentially race relations in Kenosha. And Troy, why don't you just talk briefly about that?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was a 2 hour special, and I entitled it Kenosha Will Rise. It was part of my Generation Now program, which talks about millennials and Gen Z. And I wanted to do something a little different, because as a Black person, like I said earlier, I was not surprised that something like this could happen. Of course, how it happened is surprising, but I was not surprised. And so I wanted to talk with white people about kind of the reaction, have a really nuanced discussion about race, about the right to the city. And because I thought like the issue is there. And so we did a 2 hour special with a millennial, a Gen Z, someone who was a baby boomer, And just kind of talking about what happened and kind of how we can kind of come together and unite as a city. It was not easy because getting people that week was hard. But it was a really great special, and I learned a lot, and we had a really great conversation. And it was, again, something we did on Facebook Live. So it was a video format so people could watch it, but we also aired it simultaneously on the main station. And so I'm really proud of how it came out and having a really nuanced conversation, and not just with people who are maybe more liberal leaning, but we had conservatives who were saying, I don't know what happened here. I don't agree with what happened here. And having that kind of back and forth conversation right after, I think, was extremely helpful for me to kind of hear from all people. And I think for the community to hear from people with different opinions on what was going on in their city.
And to continue on with the answer to your question, Greg, we continue to cover city council meetings, committee meetings, plan commission, where, a lot of discussion occurred about, rebuilding the city. The plan commission a couple weeks ago, took a look at some plans to for a development in the uptown area from Madison-based Gorman and Company development, and so we're covering it that way, and we it's a top priority, and of course everyone's waiting for the charging decision from the DA as to whether or not the police officer who shot Jacob Blake will be charged. And the story isn't over yet. You've got the Rittenhouse proceeding that's still unfolding. It's going to be around for a while.
Well, I certainly appreciate, gentlemen, all three of you joining me today to talk about all of the work done by WGTD to try to cover this enormous story, in many respects, probably the biggest story of our collective lives. Dave Cole, General Manager, Dave McGrath, News Director, Troy McDonald, Development Director for WGTD. Gentlemen, it's great to have you on the morning show. I feel privileged to be part of you, and thank you for telling this important story on today's morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome.
WGTD remains on holiday hiatus until January 4th, and so there are no morning show broadcasts during this period except for this special end-of-the-year roundtable that you just heard. But you can continue to hear the morning show each and every day by subscribing to the podcast version of the morning show. It's available on all of the major podcast provider platforms such as Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Be sure that you search for the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. When we're back in early January, we have some very interesting programs all lined up, ready to go, including a conversation with Angela Zimmerman, who is the new director of the Racine Public Library. And we will find out, among other things, about what she foresees for the Racine Public Library as we
continue operating during the restrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll also be talking with the director of the newest PBS American Experience documentary airing in early January called The Codebreaker, which explores the incredible work of a woman named Elizabeth Friedman, who did groundbreaking work in the field of code breaking during